Poetry on the Radio. Poetry in and around the ACT. This week, we continue our discussion with veteran poet, translator, and all-around man of letters, Keith Harrison. Plus, The Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. For Art Sound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Keith Harrison has published 10 collections of poetry, two with Macmillan of London, and his acclaimed verse translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight appears in the Oxford World's Classic Series. He also has two radio plays and a book on writing called How to Stop Your Papers from Killing You and Me. In 2023, he published an innovative memoir, Not Quite Ithaca, and his poems, translations, and essays have appeared in such publications as The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times, The Observer, London, and The Australian. An emeritus professor of English and environmental studies at Carleton College and former editor-in-chief of the Carleton Miscellany, he has received awards from the Arts Council of Great Britain, the Minnesota State Arts Council, and the University of Melbourne. He and two colleagues organized the first international poetry readings at the Edinburgh Festival. Presently living in Canberra, Keith Harrison is working on several books, including a collection of essays and a new and selected poems. At the end of last week's episode, Keith was noting some of the comic poets he takes great delight in, including Ogden Nash and James Thurber. Today we start by asking him about his own comic book of poems, the Basho poems. They're mischievous in part by not being about the known poet Basho at all. Talking about them provided an opportunity to discuss some powerful poetical uses of the short two-letter word so. I laughed out loud reading this book.
Good.
It's full of surprises in very nuanced ways. And so you just sort of ease into something. I'm thinking, for example, of the interview with Basho and the way the interviewer and Basho go back and forth. There are these tiny little leaps that we take, both with language and imagination, but it's grounded in things like pigeons.
I had a farm, and I lived on a farm in Minnesota, and a huge barn at the back of it, and that barn was full of pigeons and pigeon dung. And when you went in there, there would be this whoosh of wings. And I got thinking about them, but nothing came in the way of a poem, but a student of mine came to me. She was having terrible trouble with her haiku. She said it should have 17 syllables and it's only got 16. And I said, I wouldn't worry about it if I were you. The important thing about a haiku is not the number of syllables. It's whether you see something which is interesting. And I gave you the example of that tiny poem, Two Salmon Racing Upstream, Absolutely Still. Have you seen that, when a fish is in water and racing like mad? And I think that's the sort of thing that the Japanese poets made haiku. Let me give you another one, which is, I think, a great poem. I want to share it with you. This is by Busong. I step into our bedroom. Sudden chill. I have snapped my dead wife's comb under my heel. And as I said when I read about that, it's a tiny poem, but it's as big as Othello.
Mm-hmm.
It's just immense. And they were so good at doing that. That's the important thing. But anyway, she didn't respond to this. And I tried to get her to write about... She was writing about Basho. I said, well, tell us about what he's like. Did he have stomach aches? Did he hate his wife? You know, how is he with the fellow politicians and so on? And she didn't run with it. And then one day, one evening... I was en famille. I had a couple of friends from New York visiting, and they'd brought in some grass, which was called Panama Red, very powerful stuff. And I'd never smoked grass before, so I had a couple of tokes of this, and I got this idea. I said, you can go to the party. I've got a book I want to write tonight. So I sat down and I wrote. The Basho poems just poured out. And every time I wanted them to be funny, they turned out to be quite serious, and vice versa. And I thought, I can't follow sister, so I'll stop trying to follow, I'll just write. And at the end of it, I had, you know, 30 or 40 poems. I added a few more later on, and I got it published in a local press. And I did send it to Oxford, I mentioned in the autobiography, and John Stall is a friend of mine there, and he wrote the best letter of rejection I've ever had, where he said, we had a marvellous time reading this book, it was so funny. He said, in the long run, the editorial board decided we wouldn't publish it because it was just too funny. And I wanted to ask him, what did he think about a fellow called Lord Byron? I wanted to say, he's still on your list, you know. But I thought, best to go quietly here. So I'm disappointed that that book hasn't had a wider reception than it deserves, I think. So maybe I'll get an Australian publisher to take it up.
Mm, that would be marvellous. You're using the format of the interview to inform these poetic ideas. I love the little things in it. I love this idea of the chroneme.
Yeah.
Right. Would you explain that for a second?
Well, at the time I was writing, all the linguistics profs were talking about phonemes and other words that were a bit obscure to me, and chroneme, yes. So I just wrote that word out, and I think I'll think of whatever, six or seven things that it could stand for. And then there's one at the N, the L, and I didn't know what to do with that. So it's called chronomel. Yeah.
It is sort of nonsense, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But there's this moment embedded in it where you use the word so. And I think this is the Robert Frost out moment, is it?
Well, that's like, a funny...
Where he says so in that poem and the whole poem turns.
The kid's helping his parents in the farm and he gets his hand cut off. And my students objected to what Frost did, but the kid says, don't let him cut my hand off, the doctor, when he's had his hand cut off on the saw. Don't let him cut my hand off, the doctor, when he comes. Don't let him, sister. Stop. So. And I don't know the meaning of that word.
Every time it gets me. Yeah, well, I think it's that acknowledgement of a moment that's so fraught. And yet, time continues, and so you move past it, and that is the so, maybe. But that moment in that poem is something I think of. And so then I encounter it reading your book. It's these tiny moments, I think, that poetry affords us in a tiny word, a two-letter word. And you're being silly with it, with the chroneme, and yet underneath is this very serious reference to this very serious, horrifying poem, really.
It is a horrifying poem.
But it's so beautifully wrought. And that tension between how gorgeous this poem is and how awful the content is, really that is what poetry can do. And so you are being frisky here. You are both letting poetry do what it does, but at the same time, you're being silly.
When you're able to do that, and that works both ways, you're very lucky. But I wanted to say a little bit more about the word so.
Please.
Not so much in this poem, but you remember that Seamus Heaney translated the Beowulf.
Yes.
And the first word in Beowulf in the original English, Old English, is what? H-W-A-E-T. And it's a really strange word. Again, a little bit impossible to translate. And it really means the equivalent of what the American football player says, the quarterback says, listen up. We don't have that in English, but in the original Beowulf it says, what? And Heaney must have struggled with it for a long while, and he comes up with a wildest solution. And you know what the solution is? So. And it's marvellous because you can feel he's talking to an audience, and he's already told them something. Now I'm going to tell you a bit more. And what a wonderful translation.
Yes.
It's a mistranslation, but it goes back into the poem so deeply. I just think it's one of those words that in that particular place and also in Heaney, it's like I said to my students one time, if you take the word banana and look at it long enough, it dissolves into kind of nonsense. And you say, what could that word banana mean? And you have that feeling that all words have lost their meaning. And so now you have to scramble to get them back into their meanings. But that's what the chroneme means.
Another of Keith Harrison's books is Love, Variously.
Some of the poems are about love, some about erotic love,
yeah.
some about pain, hurt, jealousy, one called revenge, where your revenge is to not take revenge.
It's fairly straightforward, and it's about something that happened to me, which doesn't say anything about a poem at all, but I've written a lot of poems about my father, and this is one of them that I like a lot. My father whacked me with a piece of wood. 5 flashes of pain across my behind as he hoisted me by the belt. My shirt was pocked with mulberry stains where Ronnie Flood had pelted me all afternoon. I was almost 7. I'd waited in a blank room in the house and pissed my pants as he called me to the shed. All week I hated him, remembering his confusion as he tried to find a length of pine to get it quickly done. If you count them right, that's more than 30 years ago. Tonight I walk beside my father and prop his stick on a rail as we both go down into the water. One leg's mostly metal, but in the pool it floats as he swings up on his back, recalling the time he barreled across the estuary under the screaming of the gulls. He looks up at the ceiling, smiles, as all the old heaviness drops away. I walk him round, while the weak arm from the stroke kneads the water like a feeding fish, and I say, "Put your head back, you're doing fine." The chlorine water slops about his ears as the big clock on the wall measures out the seconds, watches us all. I stand on toe point as we both slide down into the darker water. It laps my chin as I grip his belt and hold my father weightless on my fingertips. So you were concerned about why I called it revenge. Well, it's obviously ironic that this is not an act of loving, and yet it was also revenge because he's disabled now and I'm not. So it plays a number of ways, yes.
The piece of wood and the stick struck me.
Yes, he was very embarrassed. He'd never hit me, he'd never beaten me before, and he didn't know what to do. He was unpracticed in it.
Mm.
And then he was reliant on a stick himself.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
We spoke with Keith last week about his friendship with Robert Bly, and Bly came up again because the next poem Keith read from his Basho poems was his satire of and homage to Bly's distinctive poetical rhetoric.
Robert Bly did a poem called Travelling Toward the Lucky Pal River, in French, Lac, the lake that talks, because the voyageurs, the French explorers, were down there getting skins and so on in the 18th and 19th century. And I'd always thought that was a very strange and interesting poem. What I did in this poem was to try to put a lot of Robert Bly stuff together and just have some fun with it. And he used to read with a great big satrap in this great big booming voice, which I can't quite imitate, but I'll try to give you some sense of what it was like. So, travelling toward the Vashkipu River, or Basho attempts to translate Robert Bly. I am walking very slowly across Minnesota inside a car with no engine and no seats. I have left the seats in 100 country towns and the old squat around on them and dream of onions. In country towns, sitting down is never the same as standing. It is dusk, but I have forgotten why. It is also Minnesota, whatever that means. The moon floats out of the turkey sheds, dragging the turkeys and their smells with it. The soybeans are myopic. You can hear them sulking and kicking each other's shins. The lamplight collapses on the grass like a spavined frog. Suddenly, the moon flaps past and smashes itself against the box elder. Wearing my bottomless car, I slouch over a bridge and listen with unspeakable sympathy while two aquarians try to screw their boat to the river. I teach them a chorus of the Vache qui pue, and they unscrew the boat. They have never heard of Missoula, Montana, where I was happy. There are all sorts of echoes of Bly in that, but he has a line somewhere where he talks about there's something about the moonlight falling on all fours on the grass. And there is the Lac qui parle, which is the laughing river. This is the Vache qui pue, which means something quite different in French, as those of you who are French will readily understand.
When you read that, I could just imagine, almost cartoon-like, these images.
Good,
and
good.
Really brilliant.
It was done with great affection. I have a lot of time for Robert Bly. Mm. Yeah, we had quarrels, but they were good quarrels.
Yes.
There was nothing nasty about them at all. And I've always admired him and always argued with him. And I felt him just to be a very valuable creature.
Oh, and the waistcoat. I thought maybe you would mention his ubiquitous waistcoat.
Oh, yes, he had a wonderful waistcoat. I'd forgotten that, yes.
Yeah, always read with his waistcoat on in public. Yeah. I asked Keith Harrison to read a poem I particularly liked, At Your Ray.
One of the loveliest spots in the whole of the Colorado Rockies, because it's got not only terribly high peaks all around it, 14,000 feet, some of them, but it has some hot springs at the base. And when you're way up top and look down, you seem to be looking at a map. And then you go down and you get into the hot springs, then you look up and you see, my goodness, was I up there? I must have had wings or something.
Mm.
At Ouray, what are the high crows telling us as they flash their wings up there like bars of flexed obsidian, then vanish, leaving in the amethyst air two tiny specks of sound? Just a word about summer poem. I wrote this poem at a time when I was going through great difficulty, and I found a refuge on a very fine commune in Wisconsin, not far from the Mississippi River, which was run by some friends of mine who were very able and very poor farmers. And they made such success of it that it's still going now, and that's 60 years ago. And this was run by about five people who had largely academic experience, but had a strong taste for the soil, and so they decided to get together and take this old barn, where it was so cold in wintertime that they used to keep their milk in the barn because that was the warmest place in the house. And it was about minus 50 out there. And Dorothy, the dedicatee of this poem, had a marvellous mother. She told me about her, although I never met her, and I incorporated that story in the poem to some extent. Summer poem. You buried your mother under the belly of the hill. You did not ask permission, carried her there, hacked out a hole, and planted her. Then planted a plum tree over her. Each year you light a ring of candles and sing the songs she cared for. You sing in joy, standing on her body, and the song goes down from your toes and into her bones, the city of insects and minerals and living things she is quietly becoming. I woke this morning thinking of her whom I never saw. Last night, a hungry deer dragged at her tree with his blind teeth and killed it. You laughed when you saw the tooth cuts. She would have enjoyed his hunger, the animal obeying himself. You will plant another tree in her, crabapple, cherry, they'll bloom, or the deer will savage them. Let it be. Our daughters bloom in the late sunlight and water splashed on their quick bodies, stripped off our stale clothes, plunged with them down to the floor of the dark pool among the mud slime and the pecking fish, rose up blowing spray, rinsing the shadows from our brains, roved like dolphins through the blue space of summer, enjoying hunger, work of our hands and backs, belly of the cow pulsing against our cheeks, the house climbing the hill like coral, the white moon striding over us as we slept with the crickets in the juicy grass. Woke this morning thinking beauty is, yes, of body. A thousand books fell from my mind, leaving only the pattern on the pinewood ceiling. Thought of the deer's teeth, our daughters, their small breasts budding, their shyness. And then we walked on the living grass over your mother's body, over the bones of many people, mothers and sisters and exhausted soldiers, over all our brothers sleeping under the hill. This poem is written about and for the same person on that commune in Wisconsin. And it's one of those wonderful days where everything is so full of a lifting light. This is a sonnet and it came very easily. I was very lucky with this one. And it's simply called Here, because I wanted to emphasize that sense that you have where you're very glad to be right where you are. You don't want to be in any other place. So here is a kind of celebration. The day was still as honey in a bowl. The maple sap came fast. With winter gone, the cattle stood beside the bright snow pool, their dung packed down and steaming in the barn. No help for it. Go get your fork and spade, for even those who serve the world with wit are trundling down into the deep barn shade and blocking up their nose and shoveling it. You hacked and grunted all day at my side. And then we heaped it, drove it up and flung great cartloads on the cornfield near and wide, breathing new air rich with earth and dung. Then stood a little while, single and whole, and the day still as honey in a bowl. It's the only sonnet in the language which is about that subject.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking
I think.
So many of your poems are about rural America.
Yes.
And they're observations that are unusual because they're sort of an outsider who's become an insider. But
I found the Midwest a very comforting place to be, and I like the people there. And I love small country towns, and that only came to me rather slowly. I was there many years, and I got to it because I do a lot of charcoal sketching, very amateurish stuff, but I do a lot of sketching of the landscape. And the landscape is very, it's a little bit like the Western District in southern, in Victoria. It's long, and you tend to do long landscapes, and you write them, as the Chinese say. You don't paint them, you kind of write them. And as I did that over many years, I began to feel that there were these creatures underneath the the undulations with their, they were humping their backs like large whales. And so the landscape then became very alive for me. It became a familiar landscape. So I have both these landscapes in my mind. There are Tasmanian landscapes and Victorian landscapes which stay with me forever. But so do the Minnesota ones. They're very different and they've got a different kind of rhythm. But they're equally beautiful, I think. But I'm glad you noticed that, Peter, because I felt that I couldn't really write about America until I learned to write a little bit about the countryside. And I wrote a radio play, which I don't know whether you heard, but it was on the BBC and the ABC. It was called The Waterman, and it's set in that farm country. And I tried to get their voices as well. It's in this collected poems here, but it's slightly different. It's emended, but I try to get that sense of the landscape and the speech.
Next week, we'll continue to talk with Keith Harrison about his translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And by the way, a radio drama version of Keith's translation is in preparation here at ArtSound FM. More about that in coming weeks. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. At Smith's Alternative in Civic on November 13, That Poetry Thing presents two Scottish poets touring Australia to publicise their collaborative collections, Wanderlust Women, Three Poets, 2021, and Wanderlust Women, Extra Baggage, 2023. Glasgow-based Leslie Benzie writes her fiercely political poems, rich in social commentary, in Doric Scots and English in her two collections, Sewn Up and Fesson Reared. She was nominated as the Writer of the Year in the 2022 Scots Language Awards. Linda Jackson has launched many literary, arts and musical events in Glasgow and elsewhere in Scotland. Her publications include a memoir and poetry collection, The Cabinet, Red Squirrel Press, 2021. Coming later in November, on the 20th, Recent Work Readings presents Kerry Greer and Adrian Caesar. This month's poetry reading at Manning Clark House on Thursday, November 23 at 7 p.m. will feature Anne M. Carson and Angela Costi from Victoria and Amelia Walker from South Australia, while they are in Canberra for the annual conference of the Australasian Association of Writing Programs, the AAWP. That's at the Manning Clark House, 11 Tasmania Circle in Forest, on Thursday, November 23 at 7 p.m. The University of Canberra Centre for Creative and Cultural Research is offering two poetry workshops soon. On Tuesday, November 28, Oz Hardwick will lead a two-hour workshop on poetry collaboration. Who Said That? Collaborative Writing. In the workshop, Hardwick, a professor of creative writing at Leeds Trinity University, will use an array of visual stimuli, both images and texts, to explore how fragments and brief encounters can stimulate collaborative work in voices which may not be one's own. Search online for University of Canberra Oz O.Z. Hardwick Workshop. Then, on Saturday, December 2 at the University of Canberra, Poetic Movements will hold a workshop, Visual Poetry 101, with poetry book illustrator Karen Florence. The half-day poetry workshop is for people who'd like to experiment with ways to present poetry visually. Search online for University of Canberra Visual Poetry 101. Applications are open for the Helen Ann Bell Poetry Bequest Award for Female Poets, hosted biennially by the University of Sydney. The Bell Award offers $40,000 to the author of a collection of poems of between 50 and 80 pages reflecting Australian culture. Entries close on Monday, December 18. Search online for University of Sydney Helen Ann Bell Poetry Bequest Award 2023. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of ArtSound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregoria Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.